This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak radio show. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak live on BBS radio every Tuesday night at 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time and Wednesday night 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, or by going to our site, www.thepeoplespeakradio.net. There you can also listen to our past shows on our iPod Ready Archive section. That's www.thepeoplespeakradio.net. You can also listen via now live via satellite on your Nokia phones. Just go to the website for details. Our guest tonight is Dr. Michael Parenti, activist and award-winning author of over 20 books, including Democracy for a Few, The Terrorism Trap, The History of a Nation. Dr. Parenti received his Ph.D. in political science from Yale University. He's taught at a number of colleges and universities in the United States and abroad, and his writings have been translated in over 20 languages. Dr. Parenti has won awards from Project Censored, the Caucus of a New Political Science, the City of Santa Cruz, New Jersey Peace Action, the Social Science Research Council, the Society of Religion and Higher Education, and other notable organizations. Dr. Parenti, welcome to The People Speak.
Hello, Basma. Nice to be on.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. Democracy for a Few. Wow, what is it, in its eighth edition right now?
Yeah. Democracy for the Few, right, yeah.
For the Few. I'm sorry, for a
no
few. That's right.
Yeah.
It seems more like a prophecy than a book title.
Yes, every edition that I write, I keep toying with the idea of calling it Democracy for the Fewer Still. But I think it's the original title.
That's almost it scary.
It does seem that the bulk of policies today are serving a very tiny minority up at the very top of the 1% of the income bracket. I mean, the estates tax is being eliminated, and that's only a small percentage was paying a portion of the immense multi-billion-dollar inheritances or multi-million-dollar inheritances that they were getting. That was the most progressive tax we had. It's been abolished, and they're going to try and keep it abolished. John McCain is for keeping it abolished and not bringing it back. And they've cut, as I say, billions of dollars in taxes for corporations and the very rich, even while indulging in deficit spending, which undermines the budget, undermines domestic spending, privatizes the federal budget, and even while launching a very expensive war. So it's the first time in our history where the federal government has launched a war and cut taxes at the same time. Not often you find that combination.
Do you think, I mean, obviously it's, like you said, it's the first time it's ever happened. What would be the reasoning behind something like this?
Well, Bush's goal has been to run up huge deficits and build up a huge national debt. The larger the debt, the more, a larger the portion of every tax dollar you pay in that has to go to paying private creditors rather than being spent on the needs of the people. So we are getting taxed very heavily, and this is the time of year when you kind of should be aware of that more than usual. We're being taxed very heavily, and we're getting less and less for it. So it's a way of privatizing the federal budget. The government, the Bush people, the White House, they are borrowing money from people they should be taxing, and they don't tax them, they just borrow. So it's an upward redistribution from the ordinary taxpayer into the coffers of rich private creditors. When Bush came into office, the national debt was $4 trillion. And what Clinton had done, I'll give him credit for that, not much else, but I'll give him credit for that, he had actually balanced two budgets and had a surplus. And if he kept that, if we kept it at that rate, we could have eliminated the bulk of the national debt. And what Bush did was he went spending like a drunken sailor, as the saying goes. And and it went from $4 trillion to $9 trillion during the course of his administration. So the goal is to spend the very federal government you're presiding over, spend it into penury, if you will, spend it into fiscal poverty, so that it won't engage in any kind of Great Society, New Deal, a Fair Deal, Welfare State, or any of those things. You get rid of that. They're sure, of course, that the people who are so driven, fear-driven by their leaders and their media about, first it was communists for about half a century, we heard that, how the communists were going to get us any day. Now it's terrorists, and the terrorists are even better, a better threat, because they actually do bomb places and things, which the communists never did in a whole century in the United States. There wasn't one act of violence of that sort by the Communist Party or any of their allies or fellow travelers. So they use that fear. They play upon the fear of the people to get them to vote an ever-growing military budget at the cost of everything else. So when you come up with something about, let's have a program for disabled children and medical care for them, which their low-income families or middle-income families can't afford. Let's just have it for every kid who needs it and all that. And they say, where are you going to get the money for that? Where are you going to get the money for that? That's the word that comes out. They pony up a $600 billion military budget. Where do you get the money for that, you know? They get it out of our pockets and from years to come, future spending. And so it is with the war that, which is estimated will ultimately cost us several trillion dollars if you add in the money on the national debt and the interest you got to pay and the veterans' benefits and costs and medical care and the VA and everything else. It comes to trillions. That this horrible war in Iraq, not to even measure or begin to imagine the cost that it is imposed on the Iraqi people and on their society.
Now, Dr. Parente, you call debt a trap. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, just what I did say, that the debt, the enormous debt, was a way of undermining domestic spending for health services, a way of privatizing the federal budget so that a greater and greater portion of your tax dollar goes to private creditors rather than to public services. You see, the government is run today by people who do not believe in public services, who do not want public services. They are defunding public health programs and closing public hospitals. They are defunding and undermining public education. They defund it, and then they say, you see, it doesn't work. Look, overcrowded classes, demoralized teachers, this, that, the other thing, not enough book supplies, and so forth. Why public education doesn't work. So the one thing Bush hasn't been able to get, he's targeted all the, he's pretty much dismantled most of the Great Society legislation, most of the reforms of the 70s, the 60s, and the 1930s. He's pretty much gotten these things done out, but he hasn't been able to destroy Social Security or Medicare yet. But they're doing it, again, by defunding. They're defunding the administration of it, so a lot of disability checks aren't getting to people who desperately need them. I know someone who lives on disability. If she didn't get that $800 a month, she would be gone. She'd be out in the street, you know. That's all she gets. She hardly can live on that.
Unfortunately, I think all of us know somebody like that.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean by the debt trap and the deficit spending gimmick.
Now, one of the things that you've also is prominent, I think, in almost all, in a lot of your writings anyway, is that democracy as we know it and capitalism you consider incompatible. Why is that? Isn't democracy, we always, here we've grown up in a country that has always told us that these are synonymous issues and that they are indeed compatible, and here you're saying that they're basically incompatible. Why and how did you come to that conclusion?
Well, let me first point out that most countries in the world are not very democratic or democratic, and they're capitalist. You've got capitalist Nigeria. There's no democracy. You've got capitalist Egypt. There's no democracy there. You've got capitalist Saudi Arabia. There's no democracy there. These are all capitalist countries. These are all countries where wealth is controlled by private hands and corporations and such have a free reign. You can go pretty much around the world. There's all sorts of capitalists. All of Eastern Europe is now capitalist, and they have more poverty, more suicide, more prostitution, more unemployment than they ever had under the communists. So the idea that capitalism brings prosperity and it brings democracy is really highly suspect. It can be questioned, you know. Furthermore, in our own history, it was the capitalists who fought tooth and nail against democratic reforms. The rich merchants and bankers and slave owners who put the Constitution together in Philadelphia, read what they say about democracy. They hated it and feared it and didn't want it and had all these checks and this and that. You couldn't vote for a senator. You couldn't vote for the president. There was an electoral college that would have to do that for you. Still does. You couldn't vote for your judges, the Supreme Court. The only thing, finally, after a fight, we could vote for House of Representatives. Most Americans in 1787 couldn't even vote because there were property qualifications. Over 50% of them were women, and they couldn't vote because they were women. Blacks, African Americans couldn't vote, many because they were slaves, but even the hundreds of thousands who were freedmen, they were not allowed to vote in most cases. In some states, Jews and Catholics couldn't hold public office. So what followed them was a history of struggle and fight to get many of these laws changed, to extend the franchise, to make things more democratic, to get rid of any repressive Alien and Sedition Acts. For instance, the first Washington administration started to suppress free speech. So why credit the capitalists for the democratic gains that have been made by the American people in the centuries of struggle when the capitalists showed no interest in such changes and reforms and, in fact, often opposed such changes and reforms? So you can't credit the capitalists for a democracy that they oppose. Historically, democracy has been a wonderful invention by the people of history to protect themselves from the abuses of wealth. That's what it was in ancient Greece. That's what it was in ancient Rome under the late Republic, which I dealt with in my book, The Assassination of Julius Caesar. That's what it was in the 11th century city-state republics in Italy. That's what it was in the French Revolution. It was the people trying to defend themselves, to get some voice so that they could have some protection, some rights, and change the nature of the laws that were oppressing them up one side and down the other.
And for our guests that are listening and are trying to grasp exactly where you're coming from on this, one of the questions that your book tries to answer is, what is the human cost of economic injustice? Can you touch on that a little bit so that we can share this information with others and so they can see what they're looking for?
The human cost of economic injustice is people having their lives cut short, children having easily cured diseases that go unattended and become more serious. Economic injustice means a defilement and destruction and contamination of our natural environment, which inflicts further damages on our health. Economic injustice means that there are people who cannot really pursue their interests or their develop their exceptional capacities, if they have any. Economic injustice means that just that, injustice. It means that a few at the top will batten and continually self-enrich themselves on the labor and the sweat and toil of those below them. So this is not really, it's not very good for the health of and well-being of our society and our country, but it's very good for the super rich. It's a very good system, and they love it. I can hear, by the way, I can hear an echo. I can hear my own voice there.
Oh, can you?
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
All right. I hope you're.
We'll have.
Okay.
I will try to adjust the sound. Hopefully, our sound system will work itself out. You said that all cultures should be subjected to critical investigation to be judged by universal human rights standards. Dr. Perini, what are these standards, and how would we go about implementing them?
Yeah, that you got from my book called The Culture Struggle, right? And what I do there is I deal with this whole question of you must not judge our culture because our culture is different from yours, and that's that. And on the face of it, that sounds quite legitimate, and especially since we've had 500 years of cultural imperialism where dominant societies have gone in and destroyed and imposed their cultural bloody footprint on other societies and cultures. But what I argue is that position of cultural relativism can often hide quite a bevy of sins and abuses. That cultures, there's nothing sacrosanct about cultures, that many cultures are oppressive, and they're not the product of all the people working together through history and developing this nice way of doing things and such. Some of the things they do are not very nice. For instance, it is the village culture of any number of countries in Central Asia and even Middle East, where if your daughter is raped by a bunch of thugs or whatever, your family has been shamed, and to restore the honor and standing of your family, you kill your daughter. And I mean, this happens. This has scores and scores of times this has been going on. So I'm sorry, I'm not going to respect that aspect of your culture. And there are people in your culture who disagree with that horrible practice, including these poor girls who are the victims. I mean, their own humanity tells them that this is, they're not going to say, oh, well, it's my culture. Well, now I've been raped, and instead of punishing the rapist, my daddy will strangle me and kill me. Well, that's the culture. You know, who's to judge? So we know there are humanitarian standards and rights that transcend cultures. A raped woman is a raped woman in any culture. A starving child is a starving child in any culture. A destroyed and contaminated environment is a destroyed and contaminated environment in any culture. So, and we have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which 120 or so countries have signed on to, maybe more by now, which state that there are very basic rights to life, to food, to employment, to safety and security of person. And these things transcend all cultures. So to say, oh, you can't judge my culture, first of all, that also assumes a unanimity of support for your culture within your culture, and it's not true. There are all sorts of people in any culture who themselves are being victimized by their own culture, and they do want things changed, and they do struggle against their own culture.
Well, exactly. And so how do we establish this kind of... how do we establish a precedent for anything like this to create parameters and criteria for these standards? I mean, after all, look at the United Nations.
When it failed
unbelievably.
Pardon me?
United Nations. Isn't that one of the things that they had struggled to do, is establish a universal human rights standard? And yet we still have, as you said, the global rape culture, the racist cultures, these cultures against women. They still exist, and how do we change it? How do we establish a system that actually works?
Well, in the countries where a lot of these terrible crimes are committed against women, and by the way, it shows you what recourse, I mean, the extremes to which people will go for the sake of convention. I mean, the power of convention.
Mm-hmm.
That convention dictates to protect the standing of your family, you got to kill your own daughter. I mean, it's crazy, you know. And then the other problem comes in when a lot of these populations, portions of these populations, migrate to Western Europe or the United Kingdom or even U.S. or Canada, and they carry on the same practices, and the guy ends up going to jail for 20 or 30 years for killing his daughter and doesn't understand why, you know, and that's his daughter. He can do what he wants with her. There are signs that things have changed. In India, for instance, where women are seem to be raped with impunity, they've been organizing literally retaliatory physical gangs against known rapists in areas. In Pakistan, you have outraged opinions from educated and urbanized Pakistanis against this small village culture. So they are fighting back. What we have to do is really publicize this and point this thing out. And point it out in our own society. I mean, you know, it's not just in Central Asia or India or someplace. In America, women are raped, and the number of prosecutions are shamefully low, you know. In America, women are abused and battered. And again, there's there isn't enough. Well, you've seen what's happened. That the thing to do is to organize, to publicize this, to imprint upon the public's mind that such things are no longer acceptable. When I was a kid, the idea of a man slapping a woman around was just, we chuckled about it. I mean, you see it in the movie or something, and nobody had any consciousness about that. Nobody got up and said, that guy doesn't have the right to hit that woman like that. And that's been changing thanks to women organizing and fighting back and educating other women and men who then themselves take a stand and oppose these kinds of injustices.
Well, again, this goes back to the human costs of all of this injustice. You know, we're going to be breaking in a few minutes, but I do want to touch on something that I find that, you know, is part of the theme throughout a lot of your work. You see globalization as a mutation of capitalism. You're not a fan. Why?
Because globalization, as the term is used now, does not just mean a global-wide trade and economy. Under the banner of globalization, what the large multinational corporations have done is remove the protections that small producers have in other countries, from Mexico all the way across to India. These protections allowed these farmers to feed the people with native-grown materials, foods, products, I mean produce, whether it be rice or beans or corn or any number of other things. And what's happened with globalization is the country goes into a trade agreement with a more mechanized country like Mexico with the U.S., and the U.S. comes in and starts dumping its goods, highly subsidized goods themselves, and the government, under the label of free trade, can no longer protect its own local productions and so on, which, by the way, are actually more efficient than the stuff that's brought in. But the big agribusiness cartels are so heavily subsidized by U.S. government and us taxpayers, and they can go in, like, let's say, going into Nicaragua, the frozen chicken, the chicken industry, I can't remember that guy's name who did the chickens. Remember him? Peru, I forget.
I'm the worst at names, you know.
You know who I mean.
But I know who you're talking about, yeah.
Maybe one of the callers will rescue us on that.
Hopefully.
Well, they went in with the frozen chickens and selling them at half the price that the Nicaraguan farmer. So the farmers are driven out of business. Now, once they're driven out of business, the price of those chickens goes right up again so the importer can make his profits. So globalization really wiped out the protections of all sorts of indigenous farming and diversities and such, so that the big cartels could take them over. Furthermore, these treaties distracted from the democratic sovereignty of the people in other countries. If they wanted to ban certain products, they couldn't do that anymore under free trade. When Denmark said, we've abandoned the importation of any product that's made from an animal that's on the endangered species list, that law, which is a very democratic law and very environmentally conscious law, that law was abolished. With globalization, Denmark was interfering on free trade, and they couldn't do that. So what's called free trade isn't really fair trade. It's wide open markets where the richest and the most subsidized and powerful can do whatever they want. It elevates the right of corporate property and investment. It makes that the supreme right over any other sovereign right that the people might have, such as labor protections, environmental protections, minimum wage laws, or small farming, and so forth and so on. All those rights are become secondary and are washed away by this free trade big corporation, so-called globalization.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have to take a break right now. You're listening to Dr. Michael Parenti, author of Democracy for the Few. Please feel free to call us and ask our guest a question. Toll-free internationally, our telephone number is 877-489-6350. And toll-free in the U.S. and Canada, 888-228-4494. Now, once again, the numbers are 877-489-6350, U.S. and Canada, 888-228-4494. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with our guest, Dr. Michael Parenti. Thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
More than 1 million children are forced into prostitution every year because of sex tourism. Morocco has become a favorite destination. The economic difficulties contribute to the alarming growth of this industry. SOS Morocco's mission is to let the world know that it's against the law, a human and moral crime to travel to Morocco with the intent to engage in sexual activity with a child. Please visit SOSMorocco.org for more information and to support our endeavors.
Seeger, what country comes to mind when you hear this? The government illegally spies on civilians, produces phony news reports. People are imprisoned without charge or access to a lawyer. Prisoners are tortured and killed, and an illegal war launched on the basis of lies in which illegal weapons are used against civilians, against journalists and hospitals. Unfortunately, the United States government is behind these actions. Fortunately, our Constitution has a remedy. It's called impeachment. Ask your Congress member to impeach George Bush and Dick Cheney. This message is sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
According to polls, a majority of Americans support the impeachment of Dick Cheney. To make people aware of this, the Honk to Impeach campaign has been organized. People will be carrying Honk to Impeach signs in front of congressional district offices and TV and radio stations. Visit ImpeachSpace.com and ImpeachCheney.org for updates of this effort. And don't forget to honk for impeachment.
This land is yours. Join us on the People Speak Radio Show every Tuesday and Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern for an hour of live interview and audience interaction with guests from the realms of entertainment, education, activism, spirituality, politics, and literature. Get involved and make a difference for the better. That's the People Speak every Tuesday and Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on BBS Radio Network.
Hello, everybody. This is Basma Farhat at the People Speak Radio with our guest tonight, Dr. Michael Parenti, author of his latest work, Contrary Notions. Dr. Parenti, can you tell us a little bit about Contrary Notions?
Yes, the subtitle is The Michael Parenti Reader. So it's a collection of articles of mine and selections from some of my books and also a few new original pieces. And almost all of them have been subjected to some revision and updating. And they cover subjects like the media and democracy and political economy and ideology and history and... there's even a few articles in there about ethnicity and and racism and the like.
Very interesting. We do have a question
email. There's a few autobiographical articles also in there, which I sneaked in. Yeah.
Well, it's an excellent book for those of you that have not read his latest work, Contrary Notions, Michael Parenti, the Michael Parenti Reader. John, in our email, John from the Canadian Rockies asks, what single act can global citizens do to improve our children's future? And then it says seven generations thinking. I'm not sure what that means, but...
What single act?
Yes.
There's so many acts, and I don't know why it's only our children's and grandchildren's future. You always hear these appeals. Our grandchildren will have to be paying this national debt. Our grandchildren will be facing environmental crises. And we're all supposed to grip our hearts for brokenheartedness for our grandchildren. It's happening right now. We are paying the cost for these immense deficits and debts with the closed hospitals and the increased taxes and the diminished services and the society that's going into bankruptcy and deregulation of banking so that you can get subprime loans and homes and millions of people being kicked out of the homes they were put in after they've been ripped off. So, and the same with the environment.
What can we do now, Dr. Parenti? What can we do now?
Okay, so that would be the question. What can we do for ourselves in our society right now? It's coming down on our heads. Well, as I said before, to organize, educate, agitate, to educate yourself, find out what the issues are, and speak out on them. Pressure your elected representatives. Pressure even the people with money and corporations and power. There are actually people within some of the corporations that are a little more enlightened than the people in the White House. I actually heard a representative of Shell talk about how we rule out nuclear power. We don't see that. Of course, they don't make any money on nuclear power, but they're not going into it, and they don't want to. They want to pursue things like wind energy and tidal energy and other kinds of things and solar energy. So the thing you could be doing is speaking out, keeping yourself educated as to how you're being mistreated. Worry about the here and now, and not about your imaginary grandchildren 70 years from now, because this earth may not have 70 years as we know it, and life can get very grim and very hard. And to seek out alternative solutions to the environmental crises and the political crises, and to confront these leaders and tell them what liars they are and what plunderers they are.
It's reading not from easy your book.
It's not, may I say, it's not easy because, right, I should read some of my books. Or visit my website, which is michaelparenti.org. But as I say, it's not easy because the people who want the changes, that's us, we don't have immense resources of power. You know, we can't finance big foundations. We don't own media and all that. It's reactionaries like Rupert Murdoch who own the media for the most part. And the people who have the resources and the power don't have an interest in making changes and improvements. So that's the problem. That's what the questioner is really concerned about, is, you know, how do we marshal enough power, impetus to affect certain kinds of democratic changes that are needed?
We have a caller on line 3, Nina from Houston. Nina, do you have a question for Dr. Parenti, please?
Hello, good evening, Dr. Parenti. It's an honor to speak with you. I heard you on a radio show before in my car going long distance, and we were very pleased with what you said and absolutely agreed with you. This is for one thing. The other thing is, for globalization, we see what globalization brings. For instance, in India, there is an American corporation which sells the seeds to Indian farmers. But these seeds don't regrow, so every year a farmer has to buy new seeds. And they don't have the money because they have to pay out too much money. And you find farmers in India committing suicide because they cannot provide for their families no more. This is globalization for us here. The big corporate businesses uses the poor countries. Then to our American problem, I have the fear. That's my fear, my biggest fear. And I'm a foreigner, as you can hear on my accent. That to turn this country around, it takes more than ever. Elections are untruthful. Votes do not get counted. Elections got stolen. So how does American people keep faith in their own country? It is very hard to say, okay, I'm going to the election, and I hope my vote is counted. It is so hard to go forward and still keep this faith. And I admire the American people to do not lose their faith in their country. Because, after all, it is a beautiful country.
I think, well, it's very true that when your vote can't be counted, when you have Diebold and touch screen electronic voting, which has shown distortions all through the 2000 and the 2004 election, in which in each case the distortions, the discrepancies between what the exit polls said, how people voted, and the way the votes were tallied, always in each case favored George Bush over John Kerry. Now that's remarkable that the polls were only inaccurate with Kerry. And exit polls are very, very accurate, generally, very accurate. So an exit poll is when you ask someone how they voted, not calling them up on the phone, because when you call them on the phone, you've already introduced a bias. Will that person be home? What about the people who can't afford to own telephones and so forth and so on? An exit poll is when you ask the people who have just voted, and they know exactly how they voted, they don't change their minds and all that, they've already just voted. And they're used all over the world, and they're very accurate. And time and again, we had evidence that that Kerry had won different districts or states even, and when the final tallies were in, Bush was given the election. That is the subversion of democracy, and that's been happening. The thing to be doing there is to challenge these exit polls, not calling for the right to a recount, because recounts are very expensive and they're rare to get, but get rid of these kind of touchscreen machines, which can easily be hacked, and go back to a more secure form of voting. You're right about globalization and the Indian farmers. That's Monsanto going in there and taking and marketing genetically modified crops and terminal seeds, I guess they're called. A terminal seed is one that produces a crop but no seed. Farmers always have a portion of their seed, a portion of their crop is used just for seed so they can replant for the next year, for the next crop. And this is taken away from them by these big companies. And it's criminal that the Indian politicians went along with it, at the expense of decent, hard-working farmers, many of whom, as you say, many, like thousands, apparently, have committed suicide because they're desperate and they couldn't support their families anymore. So, again, we
terminal
have to expose,
sounds
expose
very
what,
insidious.
What?
It sounds
Sorry.
So insidious to have a terminal seed. It's
yeah.
kind of the antithesis of what a seed is.
Exactly. And the terminal seed was developed for no other reason than to just have market control. There was no protection against fungus. There was no better, more productive crops or any of this. The function of that seed was just simply to cut off from the farmer any kind of independence and make him dependent on the company.
Dr. Perini, you seem to have a talent for stripping away at myth, and I know how I felt when I realized what was really going on in the United States of America, my country. I was devastated, but I was also fortunate, and with my history and my background, I had a lot of recovery techniques, and I had a great support system that helped me to be able to achieve some kind of peace as I was seeing the world through my new clear eyes. But not everyone has such a stable system of clarity and recovery. What do you replace the hopeless face of the situation with, especially for people that don't have those tools? What do you give them in its place? We have to give them something.
Well, let me ask you, what were your recovery mechanisms that were good for you? Can you maybe
Well, for myself, I've taught many courses in metaphysics. I teach meditation, and I was able to center myself even in the face of seeing everything that I had always believed in collapse right before me, because that's in effect exactly what had happened. When I started to see the truth, when I started to see the conditioning, when I started to see the corruption, the multinational corporations, the just the ability to see the antithesis of something like a terminal seed, what it really means. You know, it is against all the laws of nature, and I can see that now. And like I said, for me, I have that spiritual base. I have that place of understanding.
Right. You had a set of values and feelings about what the society and what the world should be that were being violated by these things. Right?
So, yes, exactly.
So I guess one of the things we should try to do is not just bounce from issue to issue, as many members of the Democratic Party do, but really take the Republicans on when they're constantly talking about values. We Republicans believe in values. We want values, values. And all sorts of religious folk and all sorts of people who feel their world is falling apart find refuge in these words. And what we've got to do is say, look at the hypocrisy of those people when they talk about values. And these are our values, and these are the kind of values that should be reckoned with and looked at. So I guess that would be a part of what to do, is to wage a counter rhetoric, a counter propaganda against the propaganda that they're putting out, but a truth propaganda, and one that says, we want this and this and this, not only because it'll help the poor and it'll do this and that, but they fit the values of the kind of society we want, and give people a picture of that society, where a society that would be equitable, a society where commodity production and profit plunder are not the ruling values of society, but rather human need and preservation of the environment and fair play and communal development. Those would be the values that we would want, and those are the ones we've got to be pushing. That was one of the effective things about what's called the 60s, the radical 60s, is that certain kinds of that, they didn't call them that, but then there were certain kinds of values that people were putting forward, saying things like, this business of going out and spending my whole life pursuing private gain and private profit is not really what I want, you know. So the conservatives have been pushing these values, and they have been pushing and propagandizing for the last 20 and 30 years. They've got everybody, they've got so many people convinced that government is the problem, and by government they mean any kind of spending for something decent. Not government when it comes to police and military and CIA and FBI and Secret Service and all that, but or strong courts that support conservative manipulation and violation of the Constitution.
Seems like these are terminal values, just like the terminal seeds. They're values that produce no fruits.
Yeah, I guess one can say that they're leading us to a terminal destiny.
Something with no fruit. We have a caller, Mike from California on line 3. For those of you that have just joined us, we are interviewing Dr. Michael Parenti with his new book, Contrary Notions, Michael Parenti, the Michael Parenti Reader. You can get more information on my...
Why do you put an extra Michael Parenti in there? It's just,
I
it's
did?
Just Contrary Notions, the Michael Parenti Reader.
Okay, I'm sorry. I apologize here. I'm just reading off the cover of the book here.
Yes.
And you can get more information on Dr. Parenti's work and information on everything that he's doing today in his talking circles at michaelparenti.org. Mike from California on line 3. Mike, what is your question for Dr. Parenti?
Well, first of all, it's a pleasure listening to Dr. Parenti. You know, it seems like the only thing Americans can do to affect change at this point is voting. I don't know how else we can bring the troops home or end the war in Iraq, or at least our involvement in it. And with that in mind, I'd like to ask Dr. Parenti, who are you voting for, President, and why? Thank you.
I don't know. I know who I will not vote for. I most definitely will not vote for John McCain. He is just... As Barack Obama said, he will be fulfilling or carrying out George Bush's third term. His voting record is right down the line with Bush. He's a reactionary, just like Bush. He supports every reactionary measure, so I won't be voting for him. I don't know who I'm going to be voting for. I'm not excited about. I would have voted for John Edwards or Dennis Kucinich, and I really worked with some enthusiasm for both of them, but they were both shut out by the media, of course. a corporate media that supported and immediately announced that the front runners were Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, both of which have major problems as far as this electorate goes. One's a woman, the other one has some partial racial minority in them. So those become issues that we deal with. But I'm not particularly excited about any of them. I don't think voting is the only thing we can do. We can also speak out, we can also propagandize, we can organize, we can help to try to create an alternative climate of opinion. We can give veterans support, resistance to troops who don't want to fight and don't want to go back, and that's being done. We can do direct actions and demonstrations against the Marine recruiters, as is happening right here in Berkeley now. Not because of the Marines as such, but because of what the role they're playing in the war they're supporting. We can communicate and challenge and question our newspapers and our radio stations. We can build, as you folks are doing, all some alternative media on the net and in the margins of society, a few community radio stations. Although many of these radio stations are getting bought up by very well-financed right-wing so-called Christian groups, fundamentalist religious groups, are buying them up more and more. But these are some of the things we can do. So it's not just voting. But voting is not to be dismissed. You know, it's something.
Right.
This idea that, it doesn't matter who gets elected, they all end up doing the same things. It's really not quite true on all those issues.
I do believe it is getting closer to true, though, as the years proceed.
Yeah, yes.
And that's unfortunate, I think. I've got a deeply, you know, we've only got a few minutes left, Michael, and I really have a big question, and this is one of the things that I've always been inspired by many of our guests, is that, you know, there is some hope, and is there hope for the human race at the rate we're going? Do you believe that we have a chance to overcome these issues?
Well, it is touch and go. one of the interesting things in the 2006 election was that the reactionaries in the White House lost Congress, even though they were stealing votes, as they did, for instance, that Allen seat, that Senate seat in Virginia. He should have lost that seat. He lost it by a couple of thousand. He should have lost that seat by tens of thousands, I mean hundreds of thousands. I mean, they wanted him out. I mean, the people did not vote for him. And so they stole, but they didn't steal enough, so he lost. But in a lot of places, the Republicans lost seats, especially in the House, that were white, middle-class, suburban Republican districts. And in other words, they seem to be losing a lot of their own base. Things are getting so bad that even people who support them, thinking that, they'll protect us from the immigration influx that will devalue our lives or wages or whatever, they want to cut back on all the taxing and spending. They're going to keep us safe and secure. Well, you find out that they were lying about safety and security. You find out that they're record deficit spending. You find out that they have no policies and all these things. They undermine the Clean Air Act. They undermine the Clean Water Act. So there are people who are having second thoughts about the Republicans. It's just so far and so long you can keep lying and deluding people before they begin to catch on that there's something wrong here and maybe we need a change.
Amazing.
But
well, it's been
a
pleasure.
As to whether there's hope, I don't know, do we have hope to hope? Should we allow ourselves to hope? We have to act as if we can win, as if we can. And, you know, history does give examples of people organizing against all sorts of odds and hopeless situations and yet prevailing. So let's give it a try.
Well, thank you very much, Michael, for being with us tonight. Dr. Michael Parenti at michaelparenti.org. Go out and get his new book, Contrary Notions, The Michael Parenti Reader, and that's no extra Michael Parentis in there this time. Thank you very much, Doctor, and it was a pleasure having you with us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen,
Thank you. Tomorrow night,
David Swanson, our host, will be interviewing former Marine Corps Sergeant Adam Kokesh, who served in the Civil Affairs Group in Iraq's western Anbar province. I will be back here next Tuesday night at 8 Eastern Time with a new guest, James Laurentine, on his new documentary, Food Matters, which is something that we're really excited about. Again, thank you very much, Dr. Parenti. Good evening.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, folks. That's it for the night. Enjoy.
Bye-bye now.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the table by the relief of death, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah.